And our sermon text today is Mark 14:53-65. And they led Jesus to the high priest. And all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together. And Peter had followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death. But they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree." And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest tore his garments and said, "What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. One of my favorite phrases is kangaroo court. Ever since I was a kid and first heard that phrase, I'm curious about it. The Oxford English Dictionary defines it as an improperly constituted or illegal court held by a mob, person, or assembly. A kangaroo court. If you're a word lover like me, maybe you're interested in its origin. It's rather obscure, though, rooted in folk etymology. The first recorded usage of the term was in a magazine article from 1853 entitled "A Stray Yankee in Texas." A Stray Yankee in Texas. I'd like to read that whole article, to tell you the truth. But in it, the author Philip Paxton talks about a judge in California gold rush who regularly awarded land claims for a price. Paxton says, "By a unanimous vote, Judge Gordon was elected to the bench, and the Mustang or Kangaroo Court regularly organized." Now, if a miner brought in a claim to a piece of land on which he'd found gold ore, and a claim jumper beat him to it, a kangaroo court would be hastily called. Here, the decision was already prearranged between the judge and the claim jumper, and they'd merely go through the formality and the motions of a trial. In the end, no matter what evidence was brought forward, the decision came down in favor of the claim jumper, and the judge would get his cut. It's thought that these courts were called kangaroo courts because of the kangaroo's ability to jump, naturally equated with the practice of the thief as jumping ahead of the legitimate claimee to the deed, to the land. Well, ever since, this phrase has appeared whenever justice is perverted and the mere motions or show of a trial is performed. History is replete with them. In the Valkyrie plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler, attempted July 20, 1944, a kangaroo court was set up to try the conspirators. It really was a show, too. There's film of this on the Hitler Channel or the History Channel. You see it all the time. George Roland Freisler regularly feigned indignity and railed against the conspirators, calling them Schweinhounds, right? In the end, they were all found guilty and hung. Joseph Stalin staged a series of show trials to, or kangaroo courts, from 1936 to 1938 in the Soviet Union, in which thousands of his own political enemies were regularly accused falsely of heinous crimes, tried, tortured, and executed. And now that the Mueller report is in, we have a third example. Actually, I'm just showing my political bias there, I guess, a little bit. Kangaroo courts. And although the term kangaroo court is relatively new in the terminology of legal history, its principle is not, is it? Wherever and whenever corrupt men have desire to circumvent justice in order to arrive at a predetermined verdict and still preserve the fig leaf of justice, there you see kangaroo courts convened. And I submit to you that although Caiaphas and his cohorts on the Sanhedrin knew nothing of what a kangaroo looked like, at this time the Aborigines on the Australian continent, they were the only ones familiar with kangaroos. They nevertheless behaved precisely like one in jumping ahead to a predetermined verdict in the trial of the one we see before us today, Jesus the Christ. And I submit to you that they presided over what we would call in the text a kangaroo court. How can we say this? Well, let's look to our text today, shall we? I have a three-point outline there for you on the inside flap of your bulletin if you want to follow along. First of all, in verses 53 to 59, our title is Judgment. Judgment. The true sons of Cain solemnly convened to countenance false testimony regarding their Maker and Redeemer. The true sons of Cain, following along with the Genesis motif we have seen throughout the Passion, the true sons of Cain solemnly convened to countenance false testimony regarding their Maker and Redeemer. Now, we saw last week the treacherous, traitorous betrayal of our Lord by Judas Iscariot. Jesus' experience in the Garden of Gethsemane, in a real fashion, reprised the experience of our first father, Adam, in the Garden of Eden. And of course, whereas our first father, Adam, failed by succumbing to temptation, Jesus succeeded by resisting temptation. Whereas the devil tempted Adam in the form of a serpent, we saw last week, the devil tempted Jesus in the very person of a disciple, Judas Iscariot. And now Jesus is being whisked away in order to be tried by the leaders of his own people, who've been following with great interest the career of Jesus of Nazareth. What say you? How will they receive him? Will they behave as impartial arbiters of biblical justice, veering neither to the left nor the right, showing partiality to neither the rich nor the poor, as they are commanded to do, but doing that which is just? Will they set aside the prejudices, the agendas they have manifest all through the gospel to this point, not letting Jesus' constant conflict with them influence their judgment now? If only, right? If only. This is what was expected. The Old Testament required it of those who rule. Deuteronomy 16, 18 to 20 says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. And you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you. But as we have already seen, they hated Jesus. They wanted him dead, and they've conspired to bring him to this point. Now they have him in their clutches. Now they have him before the bar of their particular brand of justice. What is that brand? The Mishnah, which is a commentary on the scriptures, rich in the history and traditions of Israel, they have 7 points to follow in capital cases, all of which were violated here in this trial. Number one, proceedings must take place in full daylight, not at night in darkness. All of these rules were intended to help preserve what I just read for you from Deuteronomy 16. Justice and only justice shall you follow. Number two, 2 witnesses must agree in their testimony. Number four, these witnesses must be interviewed privately and separately so that they could not, if conspire to have a false testimony, agree. Number four, a capital case must be tried over 2 consecutive days. It must not be rushed. It must not be concluded in one day, but they must have overnight, if you will, the judges to contemplate, to deliberate. That, as the Mishnah says, feelings of mercy would be allowed to arise. Number five, no capital case must be tried during Passover. Duh, right? Number six, capital cases must be convened in the temple precincts. And this, of course, not so. Number seven, evidence of innocence must be presented first and given equal weight regardless of the passion of the accusers. All of these 7 were violated here in our trial. We're familiar with a variety of judge type shows, aren't we, on TV? Judge Judy, the People's Court, Divorce Court. If these men, the Jewish Sanhedrin, had their own TV show today, it would be called the Judge Kanga Court, wouldn't it? You remember Kanga, the kangaroo from Winnie the Pooh. This is a kangaroo court that fits the classic definition, an improperly constituted or illegal court held by a mob, person, or assembly. This was called to give the appearance of justice, but which has in reality already formed its own decision beforehand. We see this scenario played out before us today. Now the chief priest and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death. Seeking testimony to put him to death. Should they not be seeking testimony that proves the truth of the matter? Not testimony that bolsters what they've set out to prove beforehand. Is it right to ignore evidence for and admit only that which is against? Jesus has taught the law with power and clarity. Matthew says the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. Should this not count for something in his favor? Jesus obeyed the law to perfection, responding perfectly to its demands in every situation. He says in John, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. Shouldn't this count for something in his favor? Jesus performed miracles that showed his compassion and love towards men. His power over the spiritual and the physical realms manifests his divine nature. He says, "Is it not lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to kill?" And he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand," and his hand was restored. Should this not count for something in his favor? In all of these instances, and many, many more, all these things did in the lives and ministry of the Jewish leaders would provoke jealousy, envy, and hatred. "I know who your father is," Jesus would tell them. The approval and approbation Jesus received from his father and the people only served to steal their determination to destroy him rather than follow him. Every miracle, every teaching discourse, every encounter with the Jewish leaders and people only served to inflame that hatred and drive them that much further rather than closer to. They were prepared to kill the Son of God, to murder the Messiah, to slaughter the second person of the divine Trinity. In this regard, their hearts and behavior precisely reprised that of the second covenant man, Cain, in his behavior towards righteous Abel. How optimistic was Eve at Cain's birth? His very name means, "I have gotten," and evidenced the hope that this was indeed the seed that would bring deliverance, even crush the head of the serpent and defeat the devil, right? As the promise was fresh, ringing yet in the ears of Adam and Eve, that her seed would crush the head of the serpent. "I have that man." But instead, what did Cain do? What did Cain do? He crushed the head of his own brother, righteous Abel, rather than the serpent. Abel was regarded by the Lord, that is, accepted with approval as righteous, while Cain was not. And like the Jewish leaders, Cain was angry and his face fell. "Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." Sin crouched at the door of the Sanhedrin. It desired them and had them. They had Jesus. Sin had them. The rulers may have ruled Israel at this time, but sin ruled over them. Sin had gained the mastery over them, even as it had over Cain. But the Sanhedrin had one great advantage over Cain. They had the one object for which Cain could only find a substitute. They had God in the flesh before them, while Cain only had a righteous representative, Abel, his brother. Do you think Cain would have done anything different with Jesus than did the Sanhedrin? Of course not. He would have clubbed it to the ground too, spilling his righteous blood into the earth, even as he did to Abel. His real hatred, Cain's real hatred and complaint was against God. His real enemy and adversary was God himself. He couldn't get his hands on them, so he slew the next best thing. The one who pleased God and had gained his approval, his own brother, Abel. So make no mistake about this. There is this impulse in every lost human breast, the desire and impulse to kill the righteous judge. The one who will one day sit in judgment over and each and every soul on earth. Jesus himself declared this about himself. "The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father." Think of it. What if you could lay your hands on this guy before he came to judge you? What if you could arraign him in your courtroom long before he judged you in his? What would you do with him? How would you treat him and judge him? One of the things I have learned to love and appreciate about the Lenten season is that it puts the brakes on whatever else you're doing prior and has you cope with and wrestle with your human nature afresh. During the rest of the year, we are taught to identify with Christ, the risen Christ, encouraged then to see ourselves as in Him. But we are also still forgiven sinners. There's that battle, that warfare that's waged constantly in us. Lent forces us to remind us that we are still redeemed sinners. We still have those remnants of our fallen nature tugging and pulling at us. Lent is kind of a six-week reality check, isn't it, on our human nature. We must see ourselves identifying here with the Sanhedrin, with Cain, with our fallen human nature. We would have done precisely the same things all of these did. Well, the Sanhedrin finds itself then in the seat in the place of Cain, only they don't have Abel. They have the Son of God Himself standing before them. What do you think they're going to do? Huh? They have the judge, their maker, in their hands to do with as they will. Christ has been marking them, measuring them. He's waiting until the great day of judgment to give final pronouncement. Well, now the tables are turned. Oh, judge, you are being judged by us. The power you thought you had over us, we now have over you. And towards this end, they attempt to give evidence in order to preserve the appearance of the justice they're required to uphold. If this guy is what he says he is, it ought to be easy, right? The evidence must be so abundant and consistent that the trial should be a walk in the park. What do they find instead, huh? Text says the Sanhedrin were seeking testimony against Jesus, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. A circus of fools, a comedy of errors. The court was full of liars. What was the judgment against men who bore false witness against the defendant? Deuteronomy 19 tells us the judges shall inquire diligently. And if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So shall you purge the evil from your midst. These false witnesses were attempting to slay Jesus. The sentence required upon them what was requisite, that is death. Instead, what happens? Classic technique employed by the Sanhedrin, taking what a man says and distorting it out of its context. Taking what a man says and distorting it out of its context. Jesus did say, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Of course, John goes on to give an explanatory note that he was speaking about the temple of his body. There's a profound irony here, too, in that Jesus was speaking of the resurrection of his body from the grave after a death by crucifixion, a death engineered by these very men before him. Well, they thought they had something in this charge. In the ancient world, the desecration of any sacred site was tantamount to a death sentence. This was true of pagan as well as biblical sites. This is why this charge in particular interested the Sanhedrin. If they can manipulate this charge to make it seem as if Jesus was speaking in a literal fashion about destroying the temple, then they can more easily make the case to Pontius Pilate that Jesus deserves the death penalty. Make it seem that Jesus was threatening the literal physical existence of the temple in a supposed vanity of rebuilding it, and the case is all made to Pilate, all but made to Pilate. That's the ticket. And yet another of the great ironies of this situation is that the very Romans to whom the Jewish leaders intend to appeal, they'll be back here in a brief 35 to 36 years to do the very thing they fear most, destroy Jerusalem and the temple. That to which Jesus alludes in a figurative fashion, General Titus will do literally. Yet how embarrassing Not even this stratagem works. Text says even about this, their testimony did not agree. Their whole case, carefully laid plan, seems to be falling apart. What are they to do? Verses 60 to 62 point to. Caiaphas isn't high priest for nothing. Judgment. The true sons of Cain solemnly inquire of the true Messiah and Son of God whether he is what he claims to be. As all of the Gospels give eloquent testimony, Jesus remains silent amidst the flood of false witnesses. What a contrast, huh? What a contrast. On the one hand, you have a bumbling comedy of errors amid 70-plus characters who cannot keep their stories straight. Yeah, I think he said something about destroying the temple back last Passover. Or was it the Feast of Booths? Oh, he said you rebuild it in 3 weeks? 5 days? Right? You can imagine the priests, elders, scribes becoming more and more frustrated by the moment as it becomes obvious that not only is all the testimony false and manufactured, but that because they sit here and tolerate and even encourage it and solicit it, they are complicit in it. By the time Caiaphas rises to speak to Jesus here, the mask has slipped completely. And it is glaring that what we have is not a properly constituted impartial Jewish court along the lines of that given in the law, but a rank kangaroo court. To this they have given testimony themselves. Why dignify these proceedings with a word? Instead of rushing to his own defense, arguing and pleading, Jesus is silent. What a contrast. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, Isaiah says, foreseeing this. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And our text for evil times, in Amos. I know how many are your transgressions and how great are your sins. You who afflict the righteous, who take a bribe and turn aside the needy in the gate. Therefore, he who is prudent will keep silent in such a time, for it is an evil time. So at this evil moment, Caiaphas steps forward. His name in Aramaic means inquisitor. See Torquemada in the background, maybe? His real name was Joseph, son-in-law to the old sage and previous chief priest, Annas. When he cannot trap Jesus in his own words, there's a proverb, chapter 29, that says, "Do you see a man who is hasty in his own words? There's more hope for a fool than for him." Jesus is no fool. So when he cannot trap Jesus in his own words, Caiaphas resorts to the old schoolyard ploy of the triple dog dare. Those of you that know Christmas Story, right? A direct question posed by the high priest could not be ignored. It would be equivalent to ignoring a judge's question, and one of our courts would be tantamount to contempt of court. The high priest, as evil and conniving as he was, yet stood as Israel's teacher and mediator. It would be contempt of court here. And owing to the religious nature of the Sanhedrin, contempt of God as well. Matthew makes this explicit. Caiaphas says there, "I adjure you," that is, I bind you by an oath, "by the living God, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." So Christ answers in two parts. Number one, Jesus properly confesses himself to be the divine Messiah of his Father. Jesus properly confesses himself to be the divine Messiah of his Father. Christ employs the revealing phrase, used by God with Moses at the burning bush. Ego eimi, I am. Ego eimi in Greek, the Greek translation of the Hebrew. Now, he's done this before throughout his ministry, revealing himself to be the divine Son of the Father before Abraham was, I am. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He has been abjured by the high priest of Israel to tell the truth on pain of death. As truth embodied, Jesus does this quite simply. I am. Secondly, in his confession, Jesus solemnly warns these powerful judges that he is ultimate judge, soon to be seated in power. There's that implicit warning to these men again. Seated in the place of God is Israel 70. He says, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. The men of the Sanhedrin would have known precisely what he was talking about. The Messianic Psalm 110 declares, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Associating himself with this psalm, he's reinforcing the claim to being his Father's Messiah. Additionally, by pointing to himself as the Son of Man, and that title, Son of Man, is a title of glory, not humility. He declares himself to be the glorious judge of the last day. Daniel 7 is pertinent here. Daniel 7 said, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, once again, clouds of heaven, wherever you see that, there's judgment. We've been learning this in our Wednesday night Bible study as we study the eschatology of Jesus. With the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. There's that title of glory, not humility. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Coming with the clouds of heaven, he will come to judge them. How full must have been this courtyard with speech for hours and hours, vain words, flooding the ears of all. How tired they must have been. How refreshing or terrifying it would be to hear something of consequence for the night. Reminds me of some of our days at Presbytery. Well, up to this point, Jesus has been silent, not hasty in his words. But when he does speak, it is with consequence. What is that consequence? What effect does it have on the Sanhedrin? Brings us to point three, verses 63 to 65. Judgment. The true sons of Cain solemnly bloviate in puffed up self-righteousness over Jesus' supposed blasphemy. Verses 63 to 65. True sons of Cain they are. With what kind of ears do we hear Jesus' adjured confession? With what kind of ears? Now, on this side of the cross, some 2,000 plus years later, reading Mark's prepared and carefully crafted gospel, we hear Jesus' words with great satisfaction as a true confession of the Son of God and the divine Messiah. With what kind of ears did the Sanhedrin hear his adjured confession? With utterly dead and lost ears. Unable by their very nature and preparation to hear anything but what they perceive to be blasphemy. Here's another crazy man, delusional in thinking that he's a Messiah. Now, once again, the Jewish Mishnah, that rabbinic commentary on the law, is valuable in sketching for us what men like these expected the Messiah to look like when he did appear. Their pre-expectations, right? God alone and could announce and install his chosen one as Messiah. I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill, Psalm 2 says, as we read today. They also expected the Messiah would provide incontrovertible proof and overwhelm all opposition. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And moreover, the Sanhedrin was charged with recognizing and affirming the Messiah when he appeared. And they, to a man, rejected him, so he couldn't possibly be the Messiah, right? In short, Jesus defied expectations, refused to match their checklist of qualifications. Instead of the skies being opened and a loud trumpet blasting and the voice of God declaring him to be Messiah, here he sat meekly in silence. Instead of marching out at the head of a grand and glorious army, sweeping away Herod and Pilate, the Roman army, Jesus sat alone, abandoned even by his pathetic fishermen and tax-collecting disciples. Instead of providing the kind of deliverance and salvation that they thought they needed and required, this fellow seemed to be hinting at another kind of salvation and deliverance altogether. Certainly, all of the candidates for Messiah and all of Israel, this was the least of all. How presumptuous and delusional and blasphemous is this fellow's confession? With such ears did the Sanhedrin hear Jesus. Now, Caiaphas's tearing of his priestly robe was a ritual response to blasphemy, ritual response. It indicated that all were unclean at the hearing of such things. The purging of sin and uncleanness must be performed. That is, the blasphemer must be stoned to death. In this way, and only in this way, will the uncleanness be purged from Israel by slaying the blasphemer. Jesus is therefore unanimously judged as a blasphemer and condemned to death. And prepared as such too. He's mocked, spit upon, beaten. Once again, there's an old rabbinic interpretation how silly some of these things got sometimes, you'll see. An old rabbinic interpretation of Isaiah 11:3, that is, he shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide disputes by what his ears hear. Interpretation of that text was something like this. Since Messiah judges by not by what he sees or hears, then he must judge by what he smells. That's the rabbinic logic interpreting that text. So in a mock allusion to this messianic quality, they cover his face, strike him, taunt him to tell him who it was that struck him. And so it is that Jesus is swept away by the judgment of Israel. And so it is that Jesus, who refused to provide the kind of deliverance and salvation expected by Israel, moves a step closer to providing the kind of deliverance and salvation ordained by his Father. Right? Thank God. Where would we be? Where would we be if Jesus had fulfilled man's expectations of salvation? Instead, God is sovereignly employing these wicked men's very expectations to provide all of our race with the actual salvation and deliverance that we need. Salvation and deliverance from our sin and misery so that we might have life in God. Peter will put it very boldly and cogently before these same men after Christ's resurrection. He will say in Acts chapter 5, "The God of our fathers raised Jesus, whom you killed by hanging him on a tree. God exalted him at his right hand as leader and savior to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins." That's the real deliverance and salvation we need. It's precisely the kind of salvation you need that I need, that all of our desperate longing race needs today, doesn't it? His death in our stead. We cacophony of Cains, are we not? His death in our stead means that God has punished your sin in him and that you are now free and cleansed and righteous to live unto God a holy and righteous life. How good, how gracious, how wide is the love and forgiveness of God. It has come to you, to me, even to these wicked men, even to these wicked men. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The record shows that as the gospel spread in Jerusalem after Pentecost, the word of God continued to increase, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests became obedient to the faith. The very ones who put him to death, come to him. The invitation is still there. Come to him today. If he can extend forgiveness to the very enemies who kill him, he can and will extend mercy to you as well. You will indeed and can find forgiveness in him and in him alone. This Jesus, Peter says, is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which had become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Believe in this name today, and you too will be saved. Let us come to that place where we find the salvation offered us, reprised for us, in the drama of the simple elements of bread and wine, the body and blood of the Lord and the supper of the Lord.